court is ready to hear argument in 060247, Ulico Casualty Company versus Allied Pilots Association.
We'll present argument to the petitioner for 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The issue in this case is the so-called Wilkinson exception to the general rule that waiver or estoppel cannot be used to create coverage under an insurance policy that does not otherwise exist in the policy. The Court of Appeals in this case used Wilkinson to revive a terminated claims-made policy and thereby expand the coverage of that policy through waiver and estoppel. The Court of Appeals did this in the face of stipulations that ULICO did not control or participate in the defense of the underlying litigation called the Allen action, and in the face of undisputed evidence from the only witness called by the Allied Pilots Association, or APA.
Well, isn't there a letter also that indicates that perhaps there's coverage for that particular action, and then the letter was apparently rescinded and...
There are two letters, Your Honor, that...
Well, what impact do those two letters have on this breach of contract allegation?
Those letters are the basis on which the APA claims that a waiver or estoppel have been worked such to create coverage where the coverage did not exist under the policy. The APA's claim is that those letters constitute the waiver and estoppel that then make this claim covered under the policy, even though under the undisputed terms of the policy it was not covered. And to get there, they rely on what has been called the Wilkinson exception in Texas. Now, I will advance two broad principal arguments here today, the first of which is that Wilkinson, at least as it has been broadly articulated by the Court of Appeals below and by other intermediate courts of appeals, is not and should not be the law in Texas.
And you'll get to that, I know, but how many courts have disagreed or disapproved of Wilkinson?
There are no intermediate appellate courts in Texas that have considered Wilkinson and said, we will not follow that. All the intermediate courts have followed it. They have applied it in varying ways, and they have come to varying conclusions. In fact, I'll discuss later that only one court in considering Wilkinson before this case actually came to the conclusion that it applied and created coverage under the policy. However, all the Texas intermediate courts that have considered it or have looked at the issue have said they will consider it as a potential exception to the general rule.
And other states?
Other states generally follow some form of an estoppel exception as well, and they have done so under varieties of rationales. Some states have statutes that govern. Some states have limited it to simply defensive provisions and conditions of forfeiture, much as we will argue today this court should. However, there is a plethora of cases out there from various states applying it, and to try to find one defining theory of the what we call Wilkinson estoppel throughout the United States is well nigh impossible.
But you wouldn't have a problem with the theory if, in fact, the insured was prejudiced by the insurer's conduct.
We would in this regard, Your Honor. The first point that we would argue for today is a rule that says that Wilkinson, if estoppel is going to be used in the Wilkinson format, that it can only be used to prevent an insurer from invoking policy defenses, exclusions, conditions of forfeiture, other defenses that the insurer might raise in response to a claim that is otherwise covered by the policy.
But now, and I understand your argument is you can't use waiver and estoppel to create coverage.
Correct.
But what if the insurer mistakenly says there is coverage, and in fact, the insured relies on that and goes way down the road and can demonstrate prejudice? What would be wrong with the Wilkinson rule?
Well, we submit a couple of things. Number one, that if the issue is detrimental reliance upon a misrepresentation, that there are other remedies for that. There are tort remedies. There are promissory estoppel remedies. There are negligent misrepresentation remedies, none of which are involved in this case. And the reason...
But why wouldn't estoppel and waiver be just as good a remedy if the harm you're trying to rectify is prejudice to the insured?
Because waiver and estoppel, as this court has recognized in the McGuire case, are defensive theories. Waiver and estoppel prevent one party from asserting some right it would have or some defense it would have to the claim. They do not in and of themselves create a cause of action. And I should point out, this is not something that is unique to insurance law in Texas. This court has held over the years in a variety of contexts that waiver and estoppel are defensive theories.
Was the insured here able to select its own defense counsel?
Yes, it was, and it did.
Is there ever a scenario where an insured selects its own defense counsel and controls the defense of an action where they may be prejudiced? How would they be prejudiced in a scenario like that?
I cannot, Your Honor, conceive of one, nor have I been able to find in Texas or any other jurisdiction cases that have applied a Wilkinson-type estoppel to that scenario. In fact, to the extent any cases have addressed it, they have all indicated that, in fact, waiver and estoppel cannot be created there because there cannot be any prejudice. And that goes basically to the underlying premise of the Wilkinson exception in the first place, which is that the insurer has a conflict of interest if it retains counsel and controls the defense of the insured, and at the same time could be, in conducting that defense, using its position as controlling the defense to prejudice the insured and advantage itself with respect to its coverage position. The cases very rarely even come up where someone would make the argument that a counsel retained by the insured should be able to invoke Wilkinson estoppel, because it flies in the face of the very first requirement and the whole premise, which is that the insurer is conducting the defense. And that's an extremely important point here today. Regardless of what Wilkinson rule the court adopts, if any, as the cases have indicated, there are three elements to Wilkinson estoppel: control by the insurer of the defense, the lack of a reservation of rights, and prejudice to the insured. And those first and third requirements, control by the insurer and prejudice to the insured, both relate back to the underlying premise that the insurer, operating through its selected counsel, has a conflict of interest. That conflict of interest is obviated when the insured has its own counsel representing it. And I submit that it's particularly egregious in this case in the context that we have stipulations from the APA, not only that they had their own counsel, but that through the entire course of the underlying litigation, ULICO did not participate in any way in any substantive or even procedural decision in how that defense was conducted, and in no way controlled the defense.
Well, I guess there could be an argument that if they were relying on insurance coverage, they may have defended the case a different way.
There could, I guess, be that sort of argument made, although...
Shouldn't have any bearing on...
Number one, it doesn't necessarily have any bearing on the conflict of interest issue. Number two, it's not been made in any case that either side has been able to find. And number three, just to make sure, in the testimony at trial, we got that fact from the APA's witness, Mr. Hoffman, who was their defense lawyer in the case, that there is nothing he would have done differently, regardless of whether or not ULICO had told him this was covered or wasn't covered. He went to great pains to point out throughout his testimony and in his contemporaneous written communications with ULICO that he was going to defend that case as he saw fit, regardless of what ULICO did.
Outside of this case, though, if I get a letter from my insurance company saying, I'm giving you a defense, I'm going to pay all your defense costs, I'm more likely to defend the case than to settle it or find some other way out. Isn't that true?
Well, I guess a couple of issues. Number one, if the insurer is providing the defense, and then obviously you would expect that the insurer is going to let them provide that defense.
But if they send me a letter saying, pick whatever lawyer you want, and I decide to pick the best lawyer in the state of Texas at the highest rate, I'm happy to do so because I know the insurance company is paying the fees.
Certainly. And in fact, you receive the benefit then of having the lawyer provide you with the best defense.
Until 5 months or 2 years later, I get a letter from the insurance company that says, well, I told you I was going to pay your fees, but it turns out there's no coverage. So now you are stuck with a $2 million bill.
And I guess my response to that, Your Honor, would be if that were the scenario and the claim were I would have chosen a cut rate lawyer, a cheaper lawyer, to defend me if it was on my nickel, then perhaps one would have a claim for promissory estoppel or negligent misrepresentation where you could show detrimental reliance damages, not expectation damages. The way to address that is not to say, okay, we will now create coverage under the policy because the insurance company was originally mistaken in saying it was there. The answer is to allow you to sue for any damages you directly suffered in reliance on that. I would have paid $500,000 and gotten a defense I was satisfied with. I thought you were paying, and so I incurred $1 million.
I understand substituting the affirmative claim for the defensive claim when you hadn't paid yet, but if the chief had paid the $2 million, or if the chief's insurer paid the $2 million, then decides there's no coverage and sues him for the $2 million, would like you to pay us back, how does it work then?
Well, that raises a very interesting question. Obviously not one we have in this particular case where that's not the APA's claim.
But the claim would be the same. I mean, whenever you all get around to finally looking at your policy in the notice and deciding this is all untimely and King's X and we take everything back, it can't make any difference whether you paid it yet or haven't paid it yet.
Well,
you're saying go somewhere else.
Again, now what I'm saying is that if there were a differential, if you paid more than you otherwise would have paid, then there might be a claim for that. But to simply say,
how do you use, what is that, a negligent misrepresentation defense?
I think either negligent misrepresentation or promissory estoppel potentially fit the bill. However, both are limited just to reliance damages, which is why the APA did not want to and did not use them in this case. Your question, Justice Brister, may also raise a broader issue that we haven't addressed and don't really need to address in this case, which is sort of the Frank's casing issue on whether or not in the abstract that the insured, having decided this is really the way it ought to be defended, can now turn around and say, uh-oh, I didn't realize I was going to have to pay for that. I thought the insurance company was, and I've changed my mind.
Well, which was a key piece of Matagorda County, that whether you're dealing with insurance dollars or insured dollars is going to affect the dynamic of the case at the outset. If I'm insured and I have no coverage and I'm dealing with my dollars, I'm likely to get a more favorable settlement. If the insurance company's representing me, that's a whole different pot that affects the whole process.
I understand, Your Honor, and as I know, that case is on rehearing and presents issues well beyond anything that we have in this case or I came prepared to discuss. My point was simply that I know that is out there. However, as it relates to our case and whether or not we now use Wilkinson to create coverage as opposed to taking the direct route and saying, you gave me a promise that I relied upon and I get my detrimental reliance damages, the proper course is to follow the established rules of promissory estoppel and negligent misrepresentation, not to take defensive doctrines of equitable estoppel and waiver and overrule essentially what McGuire says and create some new broad rationale define recovery under a policy when, in fact, that policy never did provide coverage at all.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Court, Mr. Behrman will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court. I'd first like to address Justice Medina's question of how can there be prejudice if the insured chose counsel? There can be prejudice, and there was prejudice in this case, even though the insured chose counsel, because the insurance company told the insured that it would be paying its defense costs. Based on that, the insured provided the insurer with confidential attorney-client privileged information through its counsel that it would otherwise not have provided to the insurance company. And that goes straight to the rationale for the Wilkinson
But how does that prejudice the insured in this case? Because either the policy had lapsed or not, it seems like, regardless of the exchange of confidential information.
Well, the providing of confidential information in itself is prejudicial.
But if you're beyond the lapsed point of the policy, was there any information that was communicated that would bring it back within the policy? Now, if it were in the policy and you had an exclusion or you had a reservation of rights within the policy term, then you have a Tilly situation. But in this one, it seems like whatever information they gave was not going to change the dates of the reporting or the dates of the termination of the policy.
There is a term in the policy that affects the dates of when notice can be provided, and that is the extended reporting period provision.
Okay, and you submitted that to the jury, as I understand.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's not the jury. That was NOV, and that's not brought up. Is that correct?
Well, we made the point that it was just that point we achieved a jury finding that an extended reporting period was granted under the policy. The trial court disregarded that. The Court of Appeals did not address that point.
Did you have that before the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And we're raising it again here in our briefing. You'll notice front and center that we believe that the trial court erred in disregarding the extended reporting period.
I noticed it in your briefing, but I didn't. The Court of Appeals opinion seemed to say that the cross points did not include one on the NOV.
It did.
Okay.
It did. And there was full briefing, you'll notice, both ways. Both the APA briefed that issue, and you'll notice that ULICO briefed the issue in full in response at the Court of Appeals level.
What testimony was there? The Court of Appeals opinion said that APA was denied they said two prejudices. The APA was denied the opportunity to negotiate for an extension of coverage. Was there testimony about that?
That it was denied an extension. Oh, yes, Your Honor, there was testimony to that effect from Steve Hoffman, counsel for the APA. Mr. Hoffman testified that, and just to step back, even though it's the APA's position and continues to be the APA's position that an extended reporting period was requested and was granted, Mr. Hoffman's testimony was that the extended reporting period would have been more formally requested right up front, if ULICO had told the APA early on when it had information on this notice defense that it was either going to reserve its rights as to the notice defense or that it was just going to deny the claim as to the notice defense. And so, yes, Your Honor, there was testimony on that point.
Was there testimony as to whether ULICO or any other insurer would grant an extended reporting period to cover a claim that had already been made?
Was there any testimony as to why ULICO would do that? As to whether an extended reporting period was granted?
As to whether one would be granted if the company knew that the claim had already been made. Was there any evidence why an insurer would gratuitously extend the reporting period for to cover a claim that had already been made and was not timely.
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor. I can't remember the fellow's name, but he was from Waldman Brothers. He was brought in as an expert in the insurance industry, and he
Jeffrey Shannon.
Yes, Your Honor, Jeffrey Shannon. And Mr. Shannon testified that it was customary in his view that often insurers will grant extended reporting periods in order to maintain customer relations with their insureds. And you
Mr. Shannon probably not wouldn't do that with his own money, especially if it's a big claim, right?
Who knows?
I mean, we can take judicial notice. An insurance company would be foolish to grant an extension for a huge claim so that we could pay our policyholders or investors money out on this claim.
Well, it's interesting that Justice Brister, you'd say that because, and I would I certainly understand your point that it would be...
Would you do it with your money?
No, Your Honor, I certainly would not.
Do it with mine either.
But the... the letters from Ms. Bowers came before ULICO received the bills, and the testimony in this case was that was pretty much how the process went. Whenever the APA's counsel had dealt with ULICO in the past, as the bills would be submitted at the end. So Ms. Bowers' letters came to the APA in March of 2000, then April of 2001. Then they received the bills in May of 2001 to the tune of approximately $600,000, and then started looking a little bit deeper in the file to see if they could come up with a coverage defense, and they found the notice, and
consistent with Mr. Shannon's testimony. Client relations might cover a small claim, but not a $600,000 claim.
I think that is consistent with Mr. Shannon's testimony.
What about opposing counsel's, why couldn't you bring this as a negligent misrepresentation claim? Why do we need to mess up the McGuire rule?
Well, I think this is different from negligent misrepresentation, and he also mentioned promissory estoppel. I think it's different from both of those causes
Let's
of
stick
action.
With I'm never sure what promissory estoppel is.
Me neither.
Negligent misrepresentation, I'm fairly clear on.
I'll stick with negligent misrepresentation. I would say that there's a big difference here between a negligent misrepresentation claim and this type of a claim, because negligent misrepresentation claim tends to focus on one representation or a series of misrepresentations that have been made by one party to another. Here we have more than that. We have representations that were made plus a policy. And I think that makes a big difference here that would distinguish this case from a negligent misrepresentation.
But the policy had lapsed. So you take that out of the equation and just leaves you with one cause of action, if any.
I would say that this policy had not lapsed entirely, Your Honor, because of the extended reporting period provision. This policy specifically said that it contemplated the circumstance where the insured would terminate or decline to accept renewal of the policy.
Is a claims-made policy with the tail?
It's a claims-made policy with an extended reporting period provision. Some people refer to it as a tail, and these tail provisions can take different forms. Mm-hmm. The policy, the term in this particular policy said that if the insured terminates the policy or declines to accept renewal of the policy, then the insurer can grant the insured more time to report its claim, period. It doesn't say how that would be granted. It doesn't say how it would be requested, and it doesn't purport to require any additional consideration.
Would it matter if there's a long history with this particular insured and insurer and claims being made after the tail expired and those claims being covered? Or do we need to take this on a case-by-case basis?
I think it would be taken on a case-by-case basis. I'm not sure that it would matter the sequence of events that led up to that point in time and what the policy said at that particular point in time.
As I understand, your client had purchased a new policy and had a new policy in effect.
Yes, Your Honor.
At the time it forwarded the suit papers and notice back to ULICO.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it had already moved to another insurer, had paid them premiums, knew when its policy had lapsed, I would presume, or knew when the policy, because you'd extended twice. So now, is there testimony, going back to Justice Heck's question, is there testimony that an insurance company such as ULICO faced with a suit for $18 to $62 million against a former insured who'd already moved his policy. Was there any testimony under these circumstances ELICO itself would have agreed?
I don't know that there was specific testimony, but there was certainly evidence of why ELICO would grant more time to the APA in that circumstance to report its claim. I think that it ought to be kept in mind that these, even though the APA had moved on to another insurance carrier, Legion, these policies tend to just be one-year policies. And secondly, ELICO, who had had, I don't recall how long the relationship had been between ELICO and the APA in the past. However, ELICO is an insurance company that is specifically designed for insuring unions. And so I could certainly see a circumstance where ELICO would want to maintain a relationship with this particular union, even though the union for the following year was going to have its insurance through another carrier.
If the theory underlying Wilkinson is that an insured will be prejudiced by revealing information to counsel that goes to a coverage issue that the insurer can then take advantage of, and that we shouldn't allow that to happen, that didn't occur here, did it?
There was certainly some information that was provided that could have been used, but there was no evidence in the record, Your Honor, that it was used.
Well, how could it have been used?
I believe there was some briefing or analysis with respect to the fact that the Allied Pilots Association did not represent the Reno pilots in the underlying Allen case, and that information appeared, as I pointed out in the brief, in ULICO's first amended petition or first amended answer in this case. It was on the same subject matter. Whether they used the information, I don't know.
If that second letter from the adjuster, is it Ms. Barron?
Ms. Bowers.
Bowers had contained a reservation of rights letter, you wouldn't contest their assertion of non-coverage. Is that correct?
If it had contained a reservation of rights specifically as to the notice,
same as the first letter that came.
Second letter was the same as the first letter?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
If there had been a continuous reservation of rights, then they would be entitled to assert non-coverage because the policy expired. And I understand your argument that it was extended, but putting that aside.
Sure. I think that even if the second letter had reservation of rights language in it similar to the first, I think that the APA would still have a claim for waiver and estoppel.
Why?
Because the first reservation of rights letter made absolutely no mention of the notice defense. It listed certain defenses very specifically, but it didn't say one word about a potential notice defense and what these reservation of rights letters are supposed to do.
I thought it had a kind of a Mother Hubbard.
It did. It had some supposed catch-all language at the end, which is perhaps designed to catch, to bring in anything else that they could possibly think of. But I read that language, I believe it's the last two paragraphs of the letter, as being more forward-looking. If more information comes in, we may change our minds. I think the first sentence of the second to the last paragraph in that letter talks about our coverage position is based on the information that we have to this point in time. And then from there on, I read the rest of it based on that.
Well, there's a very broad,
it's extremely
we expressly
broad.
Reserve all rights under the policy and available at law to deny coverage or rescind the policy or additional alternative bases, as et cetera, just like lawyers generally do.
Yes, Your Honor, and I read that in light of the paragraph before it, which talked about we're making this coverage determination based on the information that we have to this point, which at that point, ULICO had all the information it needed to deny the claim based on a notice defense.
But so, now, if the theory that supports Wilkinson doesn't apply here, then why should we apply the estoppel rule? I I ask you whether the theory was that information could be communicated that would then prejudice the insured, because he's the insurer can now take advantage of information that it learned in defending him to say that there's no coverage. And you say that didn't occur here, so then why should estoppel apply here?
Well, I'm not so sure that the analysis needs to include whether the information was actually usable or used against the insured. None of the cases I've seen have tried to make that, have looked at it that closely. They have looked at it more along the lines of the insured provided information, or was actually the insurer put itself in a position by assuming the defense that allowed it to receive more information than it would have received otherwise, while it had a coverage defense that it was not revealing to the insured. And that's the problem, that it is putting itself in a better position to receive information. Now, whether that information is actually usable or actually used against the insured, I'm not seeing any analysis to that effect.
And is the standard potential for conflict as opposed to actual conflict?
I believe the way it's stated is actual or apparent conflict of interest, actual or potential conflict of interest.
But
that's the way I've read the cases.
How can there be potential conflict when the insured has his own lawyer?
I think the potential conflict is that on the one hand, the insurance company is supposed to provide a defense. Even if it's paying the insured's lawyer, it's supposed to provide a defense, do something for the insured, while on the other hand, if it has a coverage defense that it's not advised it's insured about, it still has a right to collect information, even if it's paying the insured's lawyer, like in this case. There's an information.
This isn't a secret defense that you all couldn't have discovered, too. The fact was, neither side looked at the policy and the date of the claim.
Well,
it wasn't something that your client couldn't have picked up the same file and looked.
Well, certainly. And ULICO, I think, made an argument to that effect that, well, why shouldn't the insured have known about this late notice defense? Well, I think given that you have an extended reporting period provision in this policy that allows the insurer to grant more time to the insured, the APA was entitled to wait and see what the insurer was going to say about it. And they did wait, and they heard what the insurer said about it, and what the insurer said about it is we got you covered. We'll pay your defense costs. And then they said it again in another letter. And so I think the APA was perfectly justified in waiting and then listening to what the insurer had to say and then relying on that. The court will notice that I included with the handout I provided a case that I think has the best analysis of the Wilkinson exception that I've seen, and a very thorough analysis of waiver and estoppel in the insurance context in general. And regardless of which way this court decides to go on this issue, it's a very informative case. It's a very carefully thought out analysis. The case is Denison Custom Homes versus Assurance Company of America. Judge John Rainey, U.S. District Court, Southern District of Texas, Victoria. It also happens to be the most recent case that cited Wilkinson. And I'll just go through the case briefly, but it actually was a summary judgment, ended up with a summary judgment being granted for the insurance company. And the facts briefly are that a home builder was sued by one of its home purchasers. There were defects in a house that were built. Notice of claim was provided to Assurance, and Assurance was the insurance company.
What's a significant part of the case that helps your cause?
I believe the analysis in general of the case and the statement of the Wilkinson exception elements, I think, confirms our reading of what the Wilkinson exception elements ought to be.
Claims made policy?
No, Your Honor, it was not. It was, in fact, one of the distinguishing features in this case that caused the court to grant the summary judgment motion was that the policy was a builder's risk policy, which contained no duty to defend whatsoever. And the court...
But it was an occurrence policy with an occurrence during the policy term.
Yes, Your Honor, but there was no duty to defend, and the issue was whether the insurance company was on the hook for the duty to defend here. And the court found that it was not, because it could not waive a provision that was never in the policy in the first place. And the analysis is really too much for me to go into here, but it made a lot of unique points, I would say, that I've never seen in any case, one of which makes a distinction between waiver and estoppel. The court first looks at the Wilkinson exception as it's put together now. I see I'm out of time, so I'll stop talking unless there are any further questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Coming back to your negligent misrepresentation, if they had sued you for negligent misrepresentation, your defense would have been that they were not reasonable to rely, since they had a policy in hand and would have known the dates, right?
I'm sure that would have been one of the disputed facts to be tried under that claim.
It's not a disputed fact that they had the policy in hand and could have read it.
That's true, Your Honor.
So, really, negligent misrepresentation, promissory estoppel are not going to be available if the case is when was the notice of claim.
Well, whether they would be successful in this particular case when the particular problem is a lapse date that could have been seen by the insured or could have been seen by the insurer, the court may well be right. We may well have prevailed on that. However, in looking at whether or not just the abstract promise we will pay your defense costs when they really aren't covered by the policy, I think is a different issue. Every case would stand on its own.
Except opposing counsel seems to argue that there's more to it than just looking at a date of the occurrence and a date the policy expired. There's some tail or some extension on this policy that creates, perhaps, in their mind, an ambiguity.
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor. There's several points I'd like to make about that. First is that you will find nothing in the record from the two witnesses, one from ULICO and one from the APA, Mr. Hoffman, about a request or a granting of an extended reporting period. There is a provision in the policy that would allow for an extended reporting period to be granted under one of two circumstances, and the policy is very clear that if ULICO terminated the insured, then they had to provide, upon request and at a specified price, the extended reporting period. However, if the insured terminated, which is what occurred here, or failed to renew more accurately, then it was completely discretionary whether ULICO wanted to grant a new an extended reporting period upon request. There was no request made, there was no granting of an extended reporting period, and there was certainly no consideration for it. And the APA's argument is, well, we wouldn't need consideration because it said you could grant it if you wanted. Obviously, it would still be a modification of the lapse date of the contract, and therefore it would require consideration. It would, in effect, be a new contract since the contract had terminated and no request for an extended reporting period had been made. The APA has to try to walk a tightrope here before this court because the Court of Appeals said your prejudice can be found in that you didn't get a chance to get an extended reporting period. They are still trying to preserve the finding that the trial court, JNOV'd, that they did get an extended reporting period, which obviously would mean the Court of Appeals was wrong on how it evaluated prejudice. If I could very briefly just address the other prejudice argument that the APA wishes to assert, that they gave up some sort of privileged information, I think Justice Heck's question is exactly right. There is no evidence that it was used to the detriment. Frankly, there is the minutest amount of anything that is even arguably privileged that was provided to ULICO. And it was provided only after all the defense costs that they're suing for had been incurred in this case, after they'd filed a motion for summary judgment and some 2 years down the road. And what Mr. Hoffman did was he provided the APA, the ULICO finally with the bills and the briefing that he had done, all of which laid out the issues that the APA was arguing as a matter of public record. And perhaps the only thing one could find in Mr. Hoffman's submission that would arguably be privileged was his statement that we filed a motion for summary judgment. We think it's about a 50-50 shot.
Are the bills in the record?
Bills were in the record.
They're in our record here?
Yes, they are.
There seems to be some issue that perhaps the insured is in an equal position to determine coverage as the insurer. Why isn't the insurer in a better position to determine coverage and give the insured a decision as to whether or not a claim is covered or not?
We think both parties were in a position to do it. ULICO obviously did not do it correctly. Whether the APA was cognizant of the problem or not, I submit circumstantially the evidence is they were.
Does it matter?
It didn't matter to the jury, obviously. And for purposes of the Wilkinson exception, that the points we're arguing, it really doesn't matter because the question still comes back to we didn't take the defense on. They represented themselves. And you cannot have a Wilkinson exception in that set of circumstances.
With regard to the extension of the reporting period point, what were the arguments made on which the jury based its finding that the reporting period was extended? Were the arguments that the parties pursuant to the provision in the contract that you explained extended it, or were the arguments to the jury that independent of the contract, separate and aside from it, that statements and conduct created an agreement to extend the reporting period?
Your Honor, I'll confess the jury arguments not having been transcribed. I couldn't quote you what the APA's counsel argued. I will say that generally speaking, throughout the trial and throughout the appeal, the APA has argued that by acts and conduct that ULICO either was effectually granting an extended reporting period, even though nobody used those words, or that they were entering into a separate contract wholly independent of the policy. In fact, they submitted both of those as jury questions. Those are questions 1 and 2 that the jury found yes. What exactly they argued a jury argument on why they should prevail on that and what the jury relied upon, I do not know, obviously, and the jury found against us on all 4 liability questions, 2 of which were J&OB.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.